Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's broadcast brings you our very own Ron Chepsik and his colleagues, Alan Bradley, Roger Gray, Rick Talley, and Liddy Jones. They'll talk about their documentary DVD on the legendary Frank Matthews. More about them and their important film in just a few moments. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar for Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and his in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website, that's www.ronchepsik.com, and you can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist in Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown as well, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out this year. And this summer, you'll publish another book about the famous Gnawa shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie.
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. You do a great promo. I tell you, our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hot tamales. Thanks for that, Ronnie. Well, Ron, it's going to be a great show. So we invite our listeners to stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, just before we get we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the last couple of weeks, I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week now from more than 100 countries, and that's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making this show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music as our theme song. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here is this week's mailbag. This one's from Margaret of London, England. She writes, "Enjoyed your show with Robert Fitzpatrick and John Land last week. Whitey Bulger is quite a fascinating character. When I lived in Boston in the 1970s studying criminal law, his name would pop up now and again. I'm an attorney practicing here in London, and we'll be following the trial in November. My colleagues and I usually listen to an archived broadcast since you guys are on at 1 o'clock in the morning. We can't stay up that long. Great show. I love your variety of guests. Hey, any remarks, Ronnie?
Yeah, Whitey Bulger's trials is set for November the 5th. As Mr. Fitzpatrick and Mr. Land pointed out, and we hope he goes to trial, because I think it'll be a real showtime, go-time type situation. And it's nice to know that that our shows are archived, because people around the world, no matter the time slot or time that they're up, can listen to our show. And so that's one of the great, I guess, advantages of internet radio. Willie?
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. And we welcome all our guests around the world to tune into our archives. We've got about 56 of them out there. Now, hey, Ronnie, I hear you're in L.A. with Ike Atkinson there last week. What the heck were you doing down there in Sin City?
Did you see my picture? This picture of Ike and me with Superman?
Not really. No, tell us about it.
It was a real wild circus, man. Some of the strangest looking people I've seen in a long time showed up at the Hollywood show. When I took that picture beside Superman, I grabbed his forearm, and I thought it was going to be like really strong. It was puffed up with paper, so he had his biceps puffed up and all that. But it was wild. It was really, really wild. But we had a good time, Willie.
Good. That's great. That's great, Ronnie, and I'm sure that's going to give you a lot of action on your up-and-coming project. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please?
Yes, we're going to have more of the same next week. We've got Frank Matthews Part 2. This week, we have guests from our documentary, Frank Matthews' movie, Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And we're going to be talking about the life and times of Frank Matthews this week. And next week we'll pick up after he disappeared in July 1973, and talk about what happened to him. What do people think happened to him? You know, what, have we seen anything that gives us any indication that he's alive or dead? So it's going to be another fascinating show.
I'm telling you, it's going to be a great two-part series. I'm sure our listeners out there around the world will get a great kick out of it. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime, and crime news you might have missed. Now, here's this week's rap sheet item. Dateline, April 24th, 2012. Billings, Montana. Man reportedly admits to Oklahoma killing 25 years later. Hey, Ronnie, Clifford Eagle strolled into Billings, Montana police station on April the 18th and told police that he wanted to get something off his chest. At around 10:30 p.m., as one of the officers was leaving the station house, Eagle allegedly told authorities that a quarter of a century ago, when he was 28 years old, he and another guy got into a heated argument with a third man in Oklahoma about property, and he ended up shooting the man dead. Hey, Ronnie, this guy's conscience apparently was bothering him. Any comments on this strange case?
Yeah, you know, I don't think he was looking for publicity because Fox News called him up, and this guy might have some sense. He turned him down, and so he wasn't looking for the publicity, but this guy was homeless, so maybe he was looking for a warm bed and three square meals. And,
well, you never know.
Before we get too much sympathy for this guy, he was a registered sex offender. And in 2003, he pleaded guilty to rape, so he spent some time in jail. He was also involved in a prison escape on that. But it's a very strange story, and we'll keep an eye on this one and see how it develops.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, crime never pays. You always get caught in the end. Now, just before we get on to our special guest, we'll take a station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. You can listen to our past broadcasts weekly on the Internet Band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you've missed one, you can check it out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll also be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guests tonight are you, Bill Callahan, Alan Bradley, Roger Gray, Rick Talley, and Liddy Jones. You guys are going to talk about your great documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. You know, in the world of drug trafficking, Frank Black Caesar Matthews was the first of a new breed. Born during the waning days of World War II, he spent his childhood in Durham, North Carolina, as a chicken thief. He decided to cut his education short in the seventh grade and eventually made his way to Philadelphia. And the rest is history. Author Ron Chepsik and his colleagues will talk about this fascinating story and the documentary film they produced. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hey.
How you doing, Ron?
Great, great. I think we have Rick Talley. yes. who was an associate of Frank Matthews back in the early 1970s. We have Alan Bradley, my talented colleague.
That's right.
Co-produced and co-directed the documentary along with me. And we have Roger Garay, the hound, right, Roger? The inspector that chased Frank Matthews and tried to put him off the street. And how about Liddy and Bill Callahan? Are they there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, Liddy Jones, who was one of Frank Matthews' biggest buyers in Baltimore. And you'll be talking about Frank the Man. So we got a really interesting show. And we're going to start off by asking Al, Willie Hareb, my colleague, gave some details on Frank Matthews. You heard them. Is there anything you wish to add to help our listeners understand this remarkable story?
Well, so we call the documentary, the subtitles, Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And this guy, in probably 71 and 72, was probably the biggest single drug dealer in the country. And what's so amazing, he was only 29 when he disappeared. And what's so fascinating is that this guy could come from the South, North Carolina, pop up in New York in the mid-60s, and within 4 or 5 years, he had risen to a point where he was, according to the federal government's estimates, profiting over $1 million a month from the heroin trade. He was going down to Venezuela. He was interacting directly with the French Connection, and he was not necessarily always getting his drugs through the mafia, which was kind of unique at that time. And according to Liddy Jones and Rick Talley and other people who were around at that time, he was just like an amazing, you know, force of nature in the drug world. He was all over the country. People really liked him, respected him, and he helped a lot of people make a lot of money. So it's just kind of a Shakespearean character who has a lot of interesting facets to him.
And I think we forget that he did all this when he's still in his 20s. You know,
yeah, he's 29 when he disappeared, right?
Right. So he was building his empire in his 20s. Rick, tell us when you first became aware of Frank Matthews, and then I'll ask Liddy to explain to answer that same question. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I became aware of Frank after I had come from Vietnam and had actually stepped off into the life myself. And, you know, my first knowledge of him was, like, more on a social scene, you know. His name was ringing some bells. I'm from Manhattan. He was from Brooklyn. And, you know, everybody at that time kind of were, you know, the social settings, you know. He was a hustler. He was here. He was a player. He was here. He was a shot man. He was here. But we all intermingled, and we all knew who everybody was. And Frank was quiet, non-assuming, forceful, and, you know, just a gentleman. You know, he was all-around gentleman.
Right. What about you, Liddy? When did you first became aware of Frank, and how did you hook up with Frank Matthews?
His lieutenant was Mickey Beckwith. My girlfriend knew him, so he cut me into Frank. So we got along. We got traveling to the Super Bowl game and just hanging out. I just liked him. We just hooked up. We just liked each other. And he just was amazing.
Right,
you know?
Right. Mickey Beckwith was from Brooklyn, and Mickey Beckwith was the right-hand man for Frank Matthews. How much dope was he selling you at that time when you were dealing with him?
See, back at that time, it's not like the days. He used to give me like 10 to 15 keys on consignment. I ain't even have to pay for it. I can sell it and then pay you.
Right.
You know. So that's
right.
That's
how much was each key costing?
He would charge me 22. Because, like I say, it was so pure. I could cut one. I could make like 3 keys out of one. And I could sell it in Baltimore for $30,000. So that'd be his. I could pay him and still have two keys.
Right.
Oh, for yourself. Oh, wow.
Yeah, right. So that's how important drugs was back then.
Okay, Al, let me direct the questions to this. There are a lot of guests on here, and I want to make sure we get everybody into it. So we have Frank Matthews selling a lot of dope. What was law enforcement doing at this time? Roger?
Law enforcement was inheriting a case. Frank Matthews et al. In 1971, late 1971, in the task force that was set up in New York, comprised of federal agents, city police, and state police. And it was soon thereafter that we established surveillance on 130 Clarkson Avenue, which was a residence that Barbara Hinton had, who was the common law wife of Matthews. And Frank also lived at 3333 Henry Hudson Parkway, we found out, out in Riverdale, New York.
Right. There were two interesting things. The Henry Hudson Parkway, Nicky Barnes occupied the penthouse suite, right?
Yes, he did.
At that time.
He also frequented, they were building a house over in Staten Island in Toad Hill at 7 Buttonwood Lane. And that's the one that he very rarely visited early up until 1973 when he skipped. But he did establish himself there in 1973. They abandoned Clarkson Avenue and subsequently moved to 7 Buttonwood. Barbara did. And it was a luxurious house. And it was in the midst of mobsters over there in Toad Hill in Staten Island. And we had a tough time surveilling that place. But we soon learned that Beckwith and Frank and others were part of a vast organization that stretched from California to New York and many cities, many cars visiting them over in Staten Island and Clarkson Avenue.
Right. Al, you researched the period when we did the documentary. What was the ambience of the times in New York City? What kind of environment did Frank operate at that time? For one thing, there was a heroin epidemic, right?
Yes. Well, of course, Rick Talley and Liddy Jones actually lived through this time, and Roger Garay, and I wasn't there, but from my perspective, looking at it historically, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. It was the U.S. economy was doing well and the drug scene exploded. So if you were somebody selling drugs or part of the underworld, and Liddy and Rick can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like to me that was really a golden time and an easy time to make a lot of money, and especially in heroin because there were so... At the top levels, there were so few people really had huge, could had access to large amounts of heroin like Frank Matthews. So, for the guys that were getting it, they were making a lot of money. But on the flip side, it was the worst of times because it was the era in the United States when, hardcore drug use really ratcheted up, and you had a lot of people fall victim to it, and the police at that time were not prepared. They didn't have the resources. The DEA didn't even really exist yet, and the police were really playing catch up with these guys. So it was, depending who you were, it was a good time, or it was a bad time. I mean, that's the impression I get.
Right now, Rick and Liddy, first Rick, how much money were you guys making? Drug traffickers making at this time? Because there was a huge market for heroin in New York City and other cities along the eastern seaboard and other parts of the country. Describe how much money you were making at that time.
It's really hard to say how much money you were making at any one given time, but I will say it was a renaissance. The opportunities were there for anybody who was innovative enough to latch onto them, price of heroin at that time went from, you could get something that maybe could be stepped on, say, 14 times, and you could spend anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000. And it depends upon what type of market you were going into, whether it was going to be $2 bags or quarters, 65-hour quarters. You know, that determined what you would make from each kilo. So to say how much money that any one person was making, I'll just say that there was a sea of money.
Right. And I see a money, Liddy.
Okay, I can.
You swam in that money. How much sea was there for you?
Let me give you a parable. Maybe you can think about it. I got six brothers and six sisters. I bought all them houses in the county.
Oh wow!
And I bought my mother a house. She would live in a raggedy house, so I told her, don't take nothing out of this house. I bought her a brand new house, and she left all that junk she had in the house in the ghetto.
Oh, wow.
That's how much money I was making. I was making so much money, I thought it was counterfeit. I ain't thought it was real. There's another thing to show you how amazing Frank is. I got locked up in Towson, Maryland. They came in my house and locked me up. Took $22,000. I had $22,000 now. So Frank and them get mad. They said, man, do let them motherfuckers come in your house. He said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get the best lawyer in the world. He went and hired F. Lee Bailey and sent them down there to represent me in that drug case. I beat the case. But he was doing me real good. But he hurt me because, you know, that made people look at me and say, God damn, he got F. Lee Bailey. And that's when the feds got on me.
Oh.
So,
Roger, what were the challenges in at this time? You had Matthews, you had a lot of money, you had a lot of connections. You had this investigation. You discovered that, that this guy was, slowly but surely building this huge empire. What was it like for you guys? In dealing with Frank that time,
it was like a dream come true to me. I couldn't believe that, you know, a man was that powerful and had so much money. And then me, I had so much money just in being with him. Yeah. You know, so if I had, you know, making millions, we got it. Now he was just giving it to me. Now I made like $2 or $3 million. You know what he made.
Right. Roger,
money.
What were the challenges in dealing with? You know, these guys had a lot of money, and with money comes power, you know, and the ability to corrupt police, to buy protection, to move products. What was it like for you guys, Roger?
The power was in his cars that he owned. That's where he kept his foot on the gas all the time. It was tough following him. We had a hell of a time following him. Thank God we had the wiretap because he had so many girlfriends, so many places that he laid his head on, his pillow on, that it became difficult to surveil him. But the wiretaps that we had on Clarkson Avenue, on 33 Henry Hudson Parkway and Toad Hill helped us immensely. It was tough because the Italians were in control of most of the heroin that was coming in, and Frank knew that, and he was desperate to make a connection, and he did. He finally found George Ramos and others. That helped him make ends meet, shall we say, in Caracas, Venezuela.
Right. Now, the Italian mafia were an important element at that time. We had the French connection, which was breaking up, but the Italian mafia was still very powerful. Al, describe Matthew's relationship with the Italian mafia.
Well, from what we can tell, Frank... initially, like everybody else in the heroin trade, you know, was getting heroin from probably elements of the Gambino family out of the Bronx. Roger can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Frank Matthews was the target of CENTAC 2, which was the first federal sort of task force against a drug dealer. He was CENTAC 2, and the Bronx Gambinos were CENTAC 1. So the Corsican gangsters in France would process Turkish opium into heroin, smuggle it to New York and Montreal, and then certain U.S. mafia families would distribute it. Well, Frank at some point was able to do an end-around, and through somebody, it's kind of vague, some people say it was through the numbers, a Puerto Rican numbers guy out of Harlem, but we don't know that for sure, that he was able to make a direct contact with the French Connection. But what is for sure, and Roger talked about this in the documentary, there was a courier caught in Venezuela with, 22 keys of pure heroin that was for Frank Matthews that he had paid for in cash. And I'm sure that wasn't his first buy down there. So he, he was really playing at the top of the pyramid and with getting it directly from the people who were making the heroin. I mean, it was going from opium in Turkey to heroin in Marseille to Frank Matthews and then to the streets.
A real international connection, right?
That's right.
Right.
Now, hey, Ronnie, I got a quick question here
for one of the guys.
Hey, when did Frank Matthews first come to the attention of the police in New York City? And what did you guys do about it at that time?
Well, Roger, DeRay, go ahead, please.
In 1971, late 1971, we received information that a fellow named Frank Matthews, who the DEA figured he was dead in some sort of a shoot-up, either in Philadelphia or Baltimore, and we started surveilling him immediately. We learned that he was living at 3333 Henry Hudson Parkway, and that's the first that we surveilled and had the wiretap on, and it was just a matter of time before we got him.
Right. Now, in our documentary, there's a little controversy about Frank in terms of cocaine. He was one of the first big-time traffickers to bring cocaine into the country. This was before the big epidemic back in the late 70s. But, Roger, the law enforcement believed that he had a cocaine habit, right?
Yes, he had a heart problem that we found out about through Barbara Hinton. She's intimated it in a conversation with them that you better lay off that Coca-Cola. And he got frantic, and she realized too that she said too much by calling it Coca-Cola. We all knew what it meant. And it was just a matter of time before it got to him for a period of time.
Right. Now, this is one of the incredible mysteries that helps create the legend of Frank Matthews. But I know Rick and Liddy. Did you ever see Frank, use cocaine, or was there, a belief on the street that Frank was a cokehead?
No. That's surprised. He ain't even, he drank social when we go in bars and stuff. But if he'd done that, he hit that real good.
You never saw him use cocaine.
No.
I've never seen Frank use cocaine. And the way he moved and the way everybody moved back then, as you know, in that period, cocaine was a glamour drug, and
right,
only the extremely rich movie stars, athletes, underworld people even understood what it was about or had the money. But society says a drug problem, and we say get sniffed up. So you might go to a party and take a one-on-one from here, and then go back to your business. That's not a drug problem, A drug problem is when you soar out of control and you can't do what you're supposed to do. And Frank always had his wits about him. Like I say, I mostly saw Frank, one or two times on some occasions about something. But most of the times, you know, he'd be coming through. We'd say, what's up? You know, we'd be at one of the spots.
Right.
You know, he was either fly, you know, dressed real nice coming through at night, you know, and just passing through and just saying hello. Or he was coming through to see where he at, whoever he had to see. And he came dressed non-assuming and one of those lesser marks that he drove so that he wasn't really conspicuous. And he was in and out, you know, but like the one
right,
or two times that's...
Right. Lenny, what about you? Did you ever see him use cocaine?
Nah, he always kept his head clear, and he was about business, as far as I'm saying.
Right.
And you don't see nobody with you know right. cocaine do all that business he done. He so much business. If he was using coke, he was messed up.
Right.
He ain't messed
right.
up. You know, he stayed on time, kept his thing going. If you was a crackhead or coke using coke, you couldn't do that.
Right. He probably
not
used
big
the,
as he was.
Right.
Not the way they're talking about.
Yeah, no, he couldn't do that.
Right.
You know, people are and what makes it so good about that, now, people are like to see him do that before they can get an upper hand on it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're sleeping, somebody's going to get you. And he ain't never slept, as far as I'm concerned, you know. So they're allowed to see somebody use some coke or something and slip, you know.
Let's take a quick station break, Willie, and we'll get back to this fascinating discussion.
You bet. Great interview, fellas. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsik and Will Harib. Our special guests this evening are Alan Bradley, Roger Gray, Rick Talley, and Lady Jones, and our very own Ronnie Shepsik. Now back to our show.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Roger Duray, former retired DA that investigated Frank Matthews. We have Rick Talley and Liddy Jones, associates of Frank Matthews, who lived the life and times of Frank Matthews in the early 70s. And we have Alan Bradley, who's the co-producer and co-director of our documentary, the Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And Al, tell us where our listeners can get a copy of this documentary.
Well, the easiest place to get it is at frankmatthewsmovie.com. We got a digital download for $7.99. And you can also get it on amazon.com or get the physical DVD. And as Mr. Liddy Jones will tell you, you can also, we don't want you to do this, but you can get it from bootleggers in Baltimore for $2 on every corner. But We don't support that, but just just to be fair, you can get it there too, but we don't like it.
Right.
But yeah, off of our website is the best place, frankmatthewsmovie.com.
Right, frankmatthewsmovie.com. And we have a Facebook page, a fan page. And Rick Talley, you've got a book, Prisoner of Dreams, right?
Yes, it's,
right.
Yeah, it's Ricardo Talley's Prisoner of Dreams. You just go to www.prisonerofdreams.com. It's an e-book, and just follow the instructions, and you can download
right, on
it.
That. And we'll give more information about these two interesting products later in the show. But let's get back to our fascinating interview. We've been talking about Frank Matthews, the legend from the early 1970s, perhaps the biggest African-American drug dealer of the era. Bigger than Frank Lucas, as someone says in the documentary, and Nikki Barnes. We have Frank living in Brooklyn, but interestingly, Frank decides he's going to live in Toad Hill. And Roger, you referred to that earlier in the interview. Tell us what happened. He moved to Staten Island from Brooklyn.
Is one of the wise guys who lives near him approached a law enforcement source who gave him a list of gave the source a list of phone records not phone records license plate records that he took down that were paying Frank. Lo and behold. Guys showed up from Atlanta, from Baltimore, from Philadelphia, and other states. That tuned us into the Toad Hill location. He had a one of the parties he had over there was July 4th of 1972, I believe. And Jerry Miller and I, who was I was the case agent. Jerry was the supervisor of the task force group. Surveilled him that night, and we got a good record of visiting him and why, and we almost got caught. with our pants down in the field, but we cleared ourselves out of there and left.
Now, tell us about the interesting neighbors. He moved into this neighborhood, but it wasn't just any neighborhood, right?
Well, it's pretty amazing. He decides to buy this house on Tote Hill, and across the street is Tommy Three Fingers Lucchese, who's the founder of one of the five big families of New York, the Lucchese grand family. It was right across the street. And Paul Castellano, who people may know his name because he later became the boss of the Gambinos, and that's who John Gatti knocked off when he took over the Gambinos in the mid-1980s. So these two guys are living literally like across the street and down the block from Frank. And Liddy mentioned in the documentary how Frank was telling people that Carlo Gambino, who was Paul Castellano's boss, put the police on Frank, and William Callahan, the federal prosecutor, he wouldn't obviously divulge any names, but he did say that, yes, the federal government was getting information from an anonymous source, and Roger just mentioned it just now, on the block and putting two and two together. I mean, the mob was providing information against Frank. That's how badly they hated him moving over there. And you got to remember the time, the early 70s, I mean, this America was a very racist place, and you not only had the criminal rivalry, you know, they probably didn't want any black guy with money living on their block, more or less another gangster. But what's interesting to try to figure out, did Frank know where he was moved? Did he move on that block on purpose to spite these guys? Or, you know, that's if you had money in Brooklyn, that's where you moved to. You moved to Tote Hill. I don't know. It's interesting.
We can ask Liddy and Roger. Liddy first. Do you know about this? Was it common knowledge that Frank had moved in among Italian gangsters?
I thought he was just moved to a nice house. He just had money to buy a house. I don't think he was, he didn't care where he was moving. He could have bought one.
Right. So he didn't make a big deal out of it, you know.
No.
Just moving to the neighbor. How about you, Roger? Any information on why he moved there and the relationship with these big-time mobsters?
Well, it was out of the way, for one thing, for mobsters and for Frank and his family. And Barbara had decorators approaching the house, people that wanted to landscape, people who wanted to buy the house and dig up the basement, figuring that once he got arrested in 1973, we'd find money there, or he would find money there. He had gold faucets planned the gold faucets on all the
right.
Kitchens and the bathrooms.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, Frank, I guess, loved money. He loved to make it like all big-time gangster, but he forgot about it a lot of times. And we had some really funny, interesting stories about Frank and money and what he thought of money. And Rick, you have a story that you told. Explain it briefly.
One night he had came through, you know. Frank was about 9 years older than I am. So at that time, you know, that's a big, in the world we live in, that's kind of a big gap. So he was, you know, like years ahead of what me and my friends were doing. And he came through one night, he spoke to my man, and he said, look here, this is what I want. And as usual, we made our list. He dropped the money off, which happened to be
$40,000 for whatever it was he wanted at that time. And he had completely forgot that he had left that money with us. And we didn't see him again for, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 weeks. And then, you know, when we asked him about it, he just said, go ahead, man, keep that. Go ahead, young girl, go ahead, keep that. You know, so you can tell somebody, go ahead and keep $40,000.
Especially back then. I mean, that was a lot of money.
But it's a lot of money today, too, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Vinny? What about you? You saw Frank and how he viewed money.
Yeah, he. I had $65,000 from. I kept trying to give it to him, so when I did catch him, he got an attitude, you know. Said, "Look, man, don't be worrying me about that money. If you broke, keep the money." That's what he told me.
Oh man! So did you keep it or give it to him?
Nah, I gave it to her. I was thinking about getting it, but you ain't, you know, you don't play no tricks with nobody. Be fair with you like that. I ain't, you know, I wasn't going to lie and say I was broke. Right. You know, I wasn't broke. So I gave him the money because, I somebody treat me like they treat me, I'm going to treat them the same way.
Right.
And I'm not going to lie and say I was broke. And I wasn't broke, so I got the money to him about a week or two later.
Right. Roger, he had a couple of places that he packaged the heroin. One was called the Ponderosa and all that.
Ponderosa,
and,
yeah.
And you got a sense of how big his operation was, right? Investigating these houses. Can you tell us a little bit about how big his operation was from what you found?
We hit it during the summer of 1970, early 72, on a search warrant at the Ponderosa. And it was at 101 East 56th Street in Flatbush, Brooklyn. And it was a two-family house that took us knocked down the door. There was nobody home in it, but we had it under surveillance for about 3 weeks, and we knew that Mickey Beckwith ran an operation there. But 1972 was a tough year in New York City. Heroin was at a disadvantage. Coke was in. There wasn't a heroin on the streets. 3% was typical that we were buying at the time. And Frank, of course, went down to Venezuela, and the rest is history. But the mill itself, and I call it a heroin mill because it was, there were 2 million glassine envelopes uncovered in the place, and the usual Puma Sand masks, some clothing that was left by the wrappers, and a 32-gallon garbage can with about half a pound of heroin in the bottom that he was mixing with the paddle. It was tough getting in, but we managed. And it was the largest heroin mill taken in the city.
Wow. Let's take a break, Willie, and we'll go into the last segment of this fascinating discussion about the legendary drug kingpin, Frank Matthews.
You bet, Ronnie. Just after the break, I've got one last quick question. Now, at this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and Will Hrib. Now, back to Ron Shepsick and our guests for the remainder of our program.
Right. We're back with Roger Garay, retired DEA, who is one of the investigators, major investigators of the Frank Matthews operation. We have Liddy Jones and Rick Talley, who were kingpins in their own right back in those days, and they operated with Frank Matthews and worked with him and associated with him. And we have Alan Bradley, who's a co-producer and co-director of the Frank Matthews documentary, which we're discussing, Frank Matthews' story, Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And Al, again, where can our listeners get copies of the documentary? frankmatthewsmovie.com. That's our website. You can get a digital download for $7.99, or you can get a physical DVD. If you like shopping on Amazon, it's on Amazon. And, yeah, so those are the easiest places to get it.
Right, and if you're listening to this show, we talk about digital download. You can instantly get a copy of the documentary and be watching it right after the show if you want on that. And, Rick, your book, Rick Talley's Prisoner of Dreams, where can we get a copy of that? That's your autobiography, right?
That is, and you go to prisonerofdreams.com. And you pay for it through PayPal. It's an electronic book, e-book, and go through the instructions, and you get downloaded within a minute.
Right. Now, we're going into the last section, and we haven't talked about Las Vegas, and that's where, of course, Frank was arrested. Alan, what was Frank doing in Las Vegas? With, there's rumors, you know, we discussed this about money laundering. He was gambling. He was having a good time. Tell her a little bit about Las Vegas and how it relates to Frank Matthews' story.
Well, Frank loved to go to Las Vegas, as Liddy and Rick talked about. He was a real, you know, socializer, had a lot of friends, and he loved to go to Las Vegas to party. But he also, according to the federal government, and according to Mr. Liddy Jones, who saw a lot of this money, he would go to Las Vegas with huge amounts of money, and I don't know, Roger, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that what he would do was if he gave the casino, say, $3 million, they could cut him a check back for, say, $2.7 million or something, so it became legal income, and he had thus laundered some money by paying 18%, I think Roger mentioned, and the thing, and Liddy in the documentary talks about going to a boxing match and seeing Frank and Mickey Beckwith leave like 10 briefcases, not briefcases, 10 suitcases stuffed with cash in their room. So they were bringing millions of dollars to Las Vegas and laundering it through the casinos. Now, we didn't get into it, but that'd be interesting to know. You know, it sounds like organized crime at one of the casinos must have been in some way involved with taking in these huge sums of money.
Roger, Garay, would you think that was the case, organized crime? Was there any evidence that organized crime was helping drug kingpins like Frank Matthews launder their money?
Yes. He was out there for one of the fights that I can recall. And, yes, organized crime did arrange these money laundering sessions for Frank there. I don't know how much money he took, but I recall one instance where he had a to-do over a girl who he skipped with eventually from Las Vegas, Cheryl Brown.
Right.
Yeah, and he met her at a place, a smart place, on 96th Street in the city, under the stairs it was called. And Nicky Barnes challenged him to producing some money. So he says, let's meet at the motel right across the street from the 4-1 precinct. It's safe. Mm-hmm. Frank brought $4 million in cash and put it on an oak table that was in one of the rooms, and nobody could match it. I know that Liddy and Rick had money, but this guy had money. He had lots of money.
Right. Now, Rick and Liddy, you guys went to Las Vegas, right?
Yeah, I was there.
Right. First, Rick, tell us what it was like for one of your kingpins to go to Las Vegas, and what you meet, what you do. And describe briefly, please, because we're moving into the last couple of minutes of our show.
Yeah, briefly, real fast, they had what they call a High Rollers Club, you know, and that was rock stars, movie stars, mm-hmm. and hustlers from around the world. And basically, your tab was how you chose to live, the parties that you threw and the people that you hung out with at that time, the gambling that you did. And at that time, Las Vegas was an open city, you know, which really means nobody controlled it. everybody who had a piece of the action had their piece of the action, and things were pretty harmonious. But the Dunes and the Aladdin, the Riviera, you know,
right.
Those were the places to be back then.
Right.
You know?
Right. And Liddy, what about you? You went to Las Vegas. We can't get into it in too much detail, but you saw some of this action. You saw Frank there. What's going on?
Looked like everybody knew Frank, you know. I was surprised they knew so many people. Like I was saying in the document, I thought they were talking about Frank Sinatra. Yeah. So anyway, one day we went to eat. Show you how powerful he was. You know, he a country boy. You know, he come from the South. So he said, damn, I feel like eating a rabbit, you know. And so he asked the waiter, he said, y'all got rabbit in here? He said, nah, Mr. Frank, if you want one, we go catch him.
I got one for Liddy. I got a quick one for Liddy, if you don't mind. Yeah, you know, you guys described Frank Matthews as a gentleman. But when something went wrong, did he get angry? And what was he like when that happened?
Good question.
Back then, like, I just say, like, let's just say somebody messed up $100,000. You know, like nowadays, they'll kill you for that. You know, Frank won't even fuck with you no more. You can have that. And he just tell people, don't fuck with him no more. Yeah. And then he blackball them and the dope breaks, and they can't cop nowhere. That's how that was. But nowadays, they'll kill you. But when Frank when we was in, they mess up some money. Oh, man, keep that, man. Fuck it. Just don't fuck with him no more.
Right.
But they ain't like the day, you know.
Yeah.
They'll kill you for $2 bag or something, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Roger, you were getting reports that he was losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? There at the gambling table.
We figure he was losing that money on purpose.
He looked like he was reckless, but there was method to his supposed recklessness, right?
Yes, it's true. He definitely was losing. For a period of time, and we figured he was losing on purpose, but he was held in $5 million bail, and the funny part about it is he couldn't make it at first, that's when he skipped on July of 1973 when he was brought back to New York.
Now, we're going to be in the second part of this fascinating discussion about one of the amazing gangsters of all time. We're going to be talking about the disappearance, how Frank disappeared and what went on after that. And we're going to have some agents on. We're going to have an associate of his, and we're going to speculate on his mysterious disappearance. But to sum it up, and we'll get into this next week, Frank was arrested on his way to the Super Bowl between Miami and Washington, and he was brought back to New York City. And so we're going to leave it there. We're going to thank our guests for being on. We had some great guests tonight. Roger Garay, Alan Bradley, Liddy Jones, and Rick Talley.
Thanks, you guys.
Right, thank you. And be sure to pick up a copy of Rick Talley's book, Prisoner of Dreams, prisoneroofdreams.com. And Alan, to tell them about our documentary, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be interested in getting it.
Well, if you guys are interested in the show and you like hearing Liddy and Rick and Roger Garay talk about Frank Matthews, you can go to frankmatthewsmovie.com, instant digital download, and you know, it's about an hour and a half, and it really goes in depth about, you know, Frank, where he grew up at, times in New York, his disappearance. Great interviews with Roger, Rick, and Liddy in there. FrankMatthewsMovie.com.
Right.
Hey, Roger, send me them tapes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll get those to you.
Okay.
You still got the address, right?
Right. And for the ladies out there, all of our guests tonight are handsome as hell. So you're really going to have a good time, not only listening to what they have to say, but seeing them on camera. And thank you again, guys. We appreciate
thanks, fellas,
for being on the show.
Okay.
Thanks. Liddy, I'm going to call you.
Okay. Call me. You still got the address.
I'm going to call you right now.
Okay.
Okay. Willie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
ways.
Thanks, Ronnie. Hey, what a great show tonight, I'm telling you. And thanks again to our very special guests. You know what? It was a fascinating interview, and we were delighted to have everybody on the program, including you, Ronnie. Hey,
well,
what did you learn
you.
About our interview tonight?
Well, I learned that I'm a raving genius for getting these guys together and bringing them together for our documentary. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't go that far, Ronnie, but you did a damn good job.
Well,
you had
a
good support.
I'm a lot smarter than I looked, right? I'm a lot smarter than I looked.
Yeah. Right on. Well, I'll tell you, you know what? You know, I learned Frank Matthews was one powerful drug kingpin. You know, I also learned he's one clever guy who's eluded capture for a hell of a lot of years. But I tell you, if he's alive, one day I think they'll catch up with him like they do most of these criminals. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat's most notorious serial killer of the month segment, Ted Bundy. Remember this guy? He was attractive.
Yes. Right.
He was attractive, smart, and had a future in politics. He was also one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history. Ted Bundy screamed his innocence until his death in the electric chair became imminent. Then he tried to use his victims one more time to keep himself alive. His plan failed, and the world got a glimpse of the true evil he represented. Any comments about this scary dude?
Yeah, they say he was attractive, smart, and had a future in politics. Didn't they say that about you at one time, Willie?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, well, I still have a good future. Don't worry. I'm still in the game.
Right. He was also charming like you. But
well, actually, you know, Ronnie, he was born on November the 24th, the same day I was born.
You got to be kidding.
I am not kidding, man.
I think I'm going to have to watch you a little more carefully. But he blamed porn for his rape and murderous behavior, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of ridiculous. But because, you know, he was just a bad apple from the beginning. But Ted Bundy, yes, that's our serial killer of the month. Willie?
Right. Well, we'll bring you another segment of that next time around. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for May the 5th. Our guests will be filmmakers, More Sources, and our very own Ron Chepsik and Alan Bradley, who will discuss their acclaimed documentary film titled Frank Matthews Story. It's the story of the life and criminal career of Frank Matthews, America's biggest kingpin who disappeared almost 40 years ago and never to be seen again. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Rib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Good night, Ronnie. Good night, everybody.
Sleep tight, Willie.